Hello and welcome to recording number 7 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 6th, 2021. So we just were hearing in this chapter right here is Yggdrasil, Zuchtmoy, and Uz talking about Abmi and how he is now the servant of Zuchtmoy and her champion in the quest for the third part of the Artifact of Evil. So they're talking here about what kind of benefits and weapons and such they've given him. They have, let's see, they've just given him this short-handled military pick. So he doesn't have his hammer anymore. And he has this magic martel, this military pick. And what else have they given him? They've given him some some magical strength, and this odd cloth that when unfolded. And that was the second weapon they gave him. So he is going to be, stronger, and he's got a different weapon than that. That was a nice little hammer, but I suppose the martel is even more powerful. There's no quite mention here of what it does. All right, so I am going to jump to page 78, where we left off, and the second paragraph. The martel, Abmi, my former slave, is obviously magically forged of latten, inset with silver against the dogs of hell, the hells, and magicked to a degree of much power, Uz said smugly. Break. Okay, so I'm not quite sure what Latin is. Latten. And, martel is French for hammer. And what it should have is a military pick. It should have the hammer head on one end. I've seen it with a kind of clawed hammer, like a hammer that hammerhead that has like a spike to it. But this also on the reverse has a spike used for good for piercing like heavy armor. Oh, okay, and this is great. Chris has put up that Latin is a yellow alloy, identical to or resembling brass. So this martel is going to look like it's a brass weapon, but it's a heavily magicked item, brass with the silver inlay. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 78, paragraph 3. Yggdrasil, her thunder stolen, gave her son a stare that would have withered any lesser creature, but the Cambion simply bowed slightly, as if she had paid him a compliment, and smiled, so as to show his rows of pointed teeth. Uz is correct, dwarf, as far as he could go, she said acidly. The pick is of such enchantment as to be powerful enough to wound the greatest of hell's dukes. Its metal of copper and tin is finest Latin, as Uz mentioned, but its diomer is such that it is strong as adamantite. Better still, no magnetism nor iron eater will affect it. Should you not choose to use your little hammer, Abmi, this weapon will serve you most ably, and I give it in honor of your mistress, Queen Zuchtmoy, the witch concluded with a sweet smile toward that person. I thank you on behalf of my servant, Zuchtmoy said with a regal tone. Of course you are wise, dear witch, to recognize that my cause, and it will succeed, is best furthered by aiding my champion, and thus assuring your own ends will be met. We must now get to the serious matter of this contest. There followed a period of express instruction. Zuckmoy said There followed a period of express instruction. Zuckmoy told Abmi that he was to depart the grim city of Molag the next day. All of his magical gear, armor, hammer, and boots would be restored to him. In addition, the dwarf would don a deomered hat, a magical head covering that would enable him to appear far different from his true form. When he ventured forth on the morrow, Abmi would seem to be an aged female elf, one making a pilgrimage to Selene in the great temple of Alona, before she died. Of course, no such destination would ever be reached. Once in the Kron Hills, the dwarf would use the magical hat to appear as a gnome, crossing westward to gain Yolakand over the Lark Hill Mountains, the Long Range Hills, and the Penners. It is a slight deviation on me, but you must turn north and go to Hlupalu in Ket. There you will find your assistants and guards. Understood? Zuckmi queried. Yes, Queen of the Abyss. The demoness seemed pleased. When you leave the hills to go to Hlupalu, eliminate any of those still with you in the party. This poison and your own weapon should serve for that. Zuckmoy told him as she handed him a tiny vial. It is certain that one or more of those who accompany you will be spies, agents of Grazd, or some other meddler. Enter Hlupalu as a half-elf with a spade beard and yellow eyes. Go to the place called Dar Peshtwar, and there your assistants and guards will await. Whom should I seek? Abmi asked meekly. No, admonished Zuckmoy. That you will learn when you arrive in Hlupalu. Those you seek will find you, not you them. I want no slip of the lip occurring in the meantime. Those who will serve you will bear my further instructions. All right, so I'm going to break right here. I'd like this mention of the Greater Temple of Alona in Selene. So I imagine that is actually one of the things that exists. And Chris has put up a picture of the Martell.
Rust Monster.
The Rust Monster. Yeah,
Tim put up the Martell. I put the Rust Monster because they said it was immune to Iron Eaters.
Yes. That is one of the classic ones there. So you see the Martell, what it does, it has a, the hammerhead is fairly small, and that is to concentrate the force over a very small area. This one actually is interesting because the Martell they're showing actually has a small... a small, almost like a stiletto spike blade in the handle that you can draw out. That long curved spike, that is a big thing to use against armor because it will usually be strong enough to pierce plate and definitely will go through chainmail. There's a lot using it. Like a hammer, the spike gets a lot of force behind it. And then I like that this one shows, the handle blade. So that's something like what, for a military fork or the Martell, especially what Abmi would be carrying. Now, I think it's very interesting. I don't believe before when we talked about Selene, that it was mentioned that there was a greater temple of Alona there. So that would be the great temple of Alona. So I'm wondering if this is maybe the biggest temple, that we're going to find of Alona in the setting. All right. Now we get some of this business of Yolocand and the Lark Hill, which I assume are what? The Lort Mill, the Long Ridge Hills, and the Penors. Some more of the New Infinities talk where everything had to be changed.
Yeah, I think the Penors were the hills that were south of Hulupulu.
Yeah, yeah. That would be in the area leading to the, what you know, Yolocand and all, Yol, as they call it. That whole area there, you know, south of Ket. Then it goes to all, then it goes to the Ashen Desert. And then from the Ashen Desert, you've got the mountains, not, is it the Ashen Desert? Or is it the Ashen Waste? It's the area that is right before the Sea of Death.
Yeah, in this book, it's Ashen Desert. In Darlene's map, it's the Dry Steppe.
Yeah, the Dry Steppes and the Sulhoot Mountains. And as you can see, Darlene's map does have the Forgotten City, which in here is the City Out of Mind, and also shows ruins of smaller, probably smaller but powerful cities. Because what the main city survived for a while because of the power of the third artifact and the powerful mages, but it was buried, and then the lesser cities and holdings of powerful individuals were able to hold out, but only a short time. So there is supposed to be a way to cross from the Dry Steppes into the Sea of Dust. So that eventually, I think, is where we're going to be seeing Gord crossing. But he hasn't reached that point yet. All right, I'm going to restart. And it is page 79. And the second paragraph from the end. "Leave us now, dwarf," Yggdrasil commanded coldly. Abmi hesitated, but a moment, glancing up to see if the demoness would countermand the order. Zekmoy's face was absolutely expressionless, as beautiful and unreadable as a portrait by a master limner. Falling to his hands and knees, Abmi crawled backward from the metal-walled little chamber, thanking all with flowery profusion as he departed. His underlying thoughts were carefully screened by mental images of gratitude and desire to serve, a trick that he had become quite good at since falling in with witches and demons. Break. Now, you notice that, the Barren Plains here. You notice that, once again, Abmi is told to kill off all his companions, as happened when he was working with us. He's done it two or three times, I think. It's just, Abmi either abandons them or slaughters them.
And he doesn't mind.
Well, I know. It's funny, though, that it is a recurring theme with him, though. And not even with his own choice. They're always telling him, kill off all your companions. That obsequiousness, that is, there's a mention here that Abmi does obsequiousness very well. And you have to around somebody like us, and you have to when you have Abmi as a master. Most of these evil entities, they will cower before somebody stronger, including us, and they will then they'll rule over somebody in a very petty and childish way. Yeah, cower and kill, and like us doesn't hesitate to kill off his followers and even the most powerful. So there's a big turnover in the job situation there with us and these evil entities. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 79, the final paragraph. When he was gone, Yggdrasil brought the others to attention by saying, "That one is a snake and a jackal." "A fitting servant, true," Uz commented, "and a none such among dwarves. He is a warrior more able than most, if not all living humans," the Queen of Fungi boasted of her new servant. "He is the best tool we have to defeat Grazd." Uz sneered. "Bah, he would have failed me earlier had not you two rescued the situation in the Vessive and captured the middle key." "He has learned much since then, I think," the demoness said. With those we support him with, Ami will succeed," Yggdrasil said with an iron ring in her voice. "But let us now converse on a still greater topic, Grazd and his filthy slaves." Zugmoy sat up at that, and Uz stared hard at his mother. The witch smiled warmly at both of them. Seeing that she had their rapt attention, Yggdrasil explained, "It would never, never in a thousand years, be to our benefit for Grazd and his lackeys to possess any of the theoparts." Uz started to interrupt, "But you..." "I said otherwise. Of course, we need his cooperation in gaining the final key. Once dear Queen Zuckmoy has it safely, she can turn on him and the vile Katsichi. And the rest, they will be powerless against her, and their foes will rend the Braggart's petty kingdom plain from plain." "You are a dear," the demoness said, leaping up and hugging Yggdrasil. The Cambion had to smile broadly himself, thinking of how his hated progenitor would fare in such a situation. "I'm proud to be your son, mother." "Just so," Yggdrasil said dryly, smirking slightly in Uz's general direction. "Moving ahead, though, we must lay out exactly what course we will follow once Zuckmoy gains the final key." The other two assented eagerly, so the ancient witch went on, "Gratz will be hard-pressed by his growing number of enemies. Worse still for him, the boastful swine will be confined to his own personal domain. These circumstances, Zuckmoy, will enable you to send aid to us. Then you, Uz, with your demons, and you will command many hordes with the Theopart, and my skills and powers will overthrow the Brotherhood. You will destroy those scum, and then the initial key will be in our hand as well." "I will be Emperor of Earth," Uz crowed, barely able to suppress the urge to beat his massive chest in delight as he did so. Zuckmoy started to frown slightly as she witnessed this outburst, and Yggdrasil acted quickly to soothe her. "Be not alarmed, sister," the witch said, taking and holding Zuckmoy's shapely little hand. Uz, in his excitement, wrongly assumed that he would retain possession of the initial key once the Brotherhood is obliterated. But in truth, he will not need it to maintain his power, and what could be more fitting than a bestowal of that object upon she who has assured our access here? What more proper, adored Zuckmi, than you using the initial key to become queen and ruler of all the Abyss? Uz bristled a bit when he heard this, but was wise enough to hold his tongue. Still suspicious, the demoness looked sharply at Yggdrasil and asked, "Why would you hand so great a thing over to me so willingly?" "Without mention of the undying love that Uz and I hold in our hearts for you, great queen, I need only point out two simple facts. First, with the whole world of ours, what need do either of us have for more than the single key we now possess? Second, who better to hold two, and thus assure rule of the entire Abyss, than our staunchest friend and ally? You speak with wisdom beyond mortals, and the powers beyond them," the Queen of Fungi said solemnly. "I had resolved to speak of the problems which the unruly Grazd might cause, should he somehow blunder into possession of the final key, or even the initial one. I'm happy that you, dearest Yggdrasil, have anticipated my needs thus. Your once husband will never forgive the humiliation he once received at your hands. Gratst will cause much trouble for both of you, should he ever manage to gain a Theopart. Your understanding of this fact and your pledge of loyalty to me indicate that my past judgment has been correct. You, Yggdrasil, and you too, Uz, shall be the most favored when I rule the Abyss. You have the word of Queen Zuckmoy. Thanking her profusely, Yggdrasil and Uz both embraced the demoness. Shall we now refrain from this tiresome business and enjoy ourselves? The witch said with urging in her voice. Uz implored Zuckmoy to let that be the case, but the demoness demurred. There are matters on my own plane which need my attention now. After all, I must alert Suzblox and the others and make preparations. Promising to come back as soon as possible, the Queen of Fungi took her leave. As soon as she was gone, Uz turned angrily to his mother. Are you growing senile? How dare you suggest that she possess two keys, let alone pledge them to her? Mind your tongue, lest I have reason to severely punish you, Uz. Never forget that I'm your mother and guide. Then softening her tone and smiling, Yggdrasil hugged the scowling Cambion. You are my own dear son. I would never betray my own flesh and blood thus. Never suppose I would actually give anyone but you the Theopart. You will rule Earth with the strength of two keys, and none will ever be able to remove your yoke then. Let the Abyss squabble and contend as its princes will. So much the better for us. Not even Zuckmoy will dare challenge us when we hold 2/3 of the artifact. What if Gratz should somehow manage to win the contest and gain the final key? Leave that to me. It is an outcome I have considered and one which I will deal with soon. You run along and enjoy yourself as you please, Uz. I will personally descend to see your father in the Abyss and handle the contingency you speak of. I will act, and you need have no further concern. Soon all Earth will bow to you, my son, as Emperor Uz, Lord of all. Humming a deep dirge, the Cambion went off to do as Yggdrasil had suggested. Disporting himself always cleared his mind of cobwebs, and Uz knew that he must work out careful plans for ridding himself of that woman's oppressive and interfering presence as soon as he held 2 parts of the artifact. Meanwhile, it was only fitting that he did enjoy himself a bit. All right, break. It is asked here, how could Yggdrasil be so naive and believe, not Yggdrasil, how could Zuckmoy be this naive and believe Yggdrasil? And, she is the one who's gotten hold of the Theopart. And I assume that everything being said entirely is a lie, including to Uz and Zuckmoy. And I don't think Uz is that smart. He just seems very naive in a lot of ways.
Well, he's a little younger.
Yeah, but, for somebody who, I believe he's supposed to have high intelligence, he's got this deep naivete, and he seems, especially around Yggdrasil, very much like a child. Now, I think that Zuckmoy is smart enough not to believe a word that Yggdrasil is saying. And until she gets the Theopart in her hands, let alone the second one, I don't think she's going to believe anything from Yggdrasil. And after that, if she actually gets them, it'll be too late.
Yeah, all that stuff that Yggdrasil was saying about how much she loves Zuckmoy. She would never hurt Uz. I don't believe a word.
No. And there are interesting things here. Now, Evil was human, so she should have certain tastes for human beauty. And so she's beautiful when she wants to be. Zuckmoy's beautiful when she wants to be. But if you notice, they're like us, he finds beauty in the like the great ugliness of things. And so their reactions to, and like the, how they reaffirmed that Abmi is a snake and a jackal. And Uz says, well, that's the perfect servant, you know. And yet, when they talk about love and loyalty as if their value system would be the same as a human value system. They transform themselves into beautiful women. You know, it is a little strange that Yggdrasil, I can believe, because she was human at one point, but Zuckmoy is really some kind of animate fungus. And yet she is using, you know, like they're both ultimately, you know, incredibly evil, but they're, when they talk to themselves, they talk about loyalty and love and all these things that really are, shouldn't be a part of their way of thinking. You know, I mean, it's very difficult to write the reverse in a believable way, you know, that good is bad and bad is good. But they do, I think, need something more than expressing things in from like a good point of view. I think it would have been better if they expressed things more as, you know, about self-concern and self-interest as the greatest thing that they can do, rather than like pledging loyalty that is just not going to be there. Because I, you know, like I said, I don't see any of them believing in what is being said. So I don't really see why they would ever, you know. Yes, and it's tough for Evil to negotiate alliances without the vocabulary of good. It's tough to write it that way, but what you can do is just talk in terms that they're more interested in, of self-interest and greater power, so that like they wouldn't be expecting loyalty, but they would be expecting you know, the smart enough to know that if they band together, they're stronger and able to overcome their enemies and reach, you know, and expand their power and reach their goals, rather than talking anything about being really loyal to each other. I think that like Gygax reached this point and he wanted to show them have an alliance, but I think that they could never express themselves in the same way that a non-demonic, you know, evil force would. I think it would have been. It doesn't seem realistic to me for Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy to be expressing normal thought processes of good creatures, where they're talking about being like sisters and love they have for each other. I don't think they would have any concept of anything but self-love, and I don't think it would be part of their vocabulary. So, like, if I were going to portray them, I wouldn't portray them having these expressions of like human emotion. I wouldn't include that with what, you know, makes up Zuckmoy or Gratzt or Uz, where they don't even have a concept of things like, you know, love or loyalty. I just, because they don't have it in them, I don't think they'd be using that. It doesn't make sense to me for them to be talking in terms that somebody who was good could understand. I think they'd be talking in terms at most of, you know, we're powerful together, we can defeat our enemies together, you know, rather than talking about them being like sisters or feeling love for each other. So that is the end of chapter number 4. So we finished up chapter 4 on page 83. I thought that was fine as far as the story went, giving out some talk of their I would say it's an interesting take on evil that they should be so unable to see common cause. It's like this business where I do think that it doesn't make sense to me that they slaughter their own followers, but it makes sense to them, and I think that is more appropriate than expressing things like love or loyalty. So I do find that a little bit off, having Uz and Zuckmoy have these loving expressions and this sisterhood stuff. I think it would have to be much more that they, see their relative power and they have use for one another. So I would say that there's never any thought of, relations. Like when Uz talks about being, hating a Gratzt, that makes sense to me. But when, Yggdrasil talks about Uz being a son, it just seems that obviously false, that everybody should notice. You know, Uz should be perfectly aware, and Uz hates Yggdrasil, and I just don't see any reason for them to express any kind of feeling for each other. Just that Uz is definitely one of those who will. He's almost exactly like Abmi. Abmi's almost exactly like Uz. Abmi bows before the more powerful and scrapes and bows, and he then rules over anybody who is weaker than him with like a childlike petty, pettiness, and where nobody's life other than his own has any value. So that, I think, is much more believable than using good values among the evil creatures. I just think that wouldn't make sense with their actions, and I see them much more as purely evil and not even thinking in ways of good. All right.
Yeah, I can see him expressing fear and respect, but respect for the power, not really for the person.
Yeah. All right, there was a lot of story going on there, but not much in terms of, like, lore or anything, so that went by pretty quick. I'm going to restart. It's chapter 5, page 84 in the first paragraph. The deep darkness of Grat's own layer of the abyss pleased Yclavdra. Blackness reminded her of her own homeland deep beneath the surface of Earth. A mockery of a tropical paradise where demon-inflicted pain and suffering befell helpless and unsuspecting creatures satisfied and pleased her senses. The worst of the drow city of Ur-Lisandatu, a sink of debauchery and base cruelty, could not compare for a moment to this wonderful place ruled by the Demon King. All right, break. So, I am not sure whether Ur-Lisandatu is the Vault of the Drow, or whether it is another city. There aren't really many Drow cities named. Now, I'm not sure if this is a new Finitiesism, where the Vault is, named like, named this. Oh, also, from yesterday's recording, there was a lot of interest about that name of the mountain, when the mountain dwarves were giving Gord, because a Gord that amulet of gold, because there's so little information on the old kingdoms of the dwarves. And I took it to be a kingdom, but I don't know if I got the name right when I was telling Anna and Jay about it. But they were both very interested in that.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was a good discussion. I think it's somewhere in the Barrier Peaks.
Oh, yes, definitely between, you know, I don't think those 200 dwarves left left that area alone. But we don't really know if that place still exists. They said it was ancient. So you figure dwarves live, what, a couple hundred years? Ancient to them could be a couple thousand, you know. And so I don't know if it still exists, but even just as a note of an old dwarven kingdom or city, that's a wonderful, wonderful little addition. Now here we have this Ur-Lissandatu, and we have to think whether it is the Vault of the Drow or another Drow city. Now, just because the D series only detail a tiny amount of spaces on that map doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a number of other Drow cities and a lot of other stuff under. There should be huge amounts of stuff in the Underdark. It covers, you know, it's beneath the Flaness. It's beneath the Back Lunish areas. It just expands it. It's huge. And because it's multiple level, that, you know, as deeper you go, you can find things up and down as well as side by side. So there could be, you know, several times as many cities and towns and, you know, dwellings and creatures in the Underdark than there are on the top. The top is just like one level, and the Underdark just goes down, down, down. So there could be any number of levels in the Underearth. So I like to think of this one as a different Drow city. Now, the other thing is, we were just talking about how there should be a different viewpoint. And Eclavda right here has that different viewpoint, where she is pleased by seeing that beautiful little park there to be ravaged by the demons. And she considers that beautiful. And the dark, evil plain of Grazitz in the Abyss is a wonderful place, better than her homeland, because it's a cruel and evil place. Now, see, that's, I think, makes more sense with these habitually evil creatures than have them a kind of parody the way people, good people, think. You know, it is more of a reversal, but it's still, I think, more in line of how these evil creatures would have to think. All right, I'm going to restart. It is paragraph 2, page 84. Best of all, the beautiful dark elf female enjoyed her status on this weird abyssal plane. Because of her own prowess and Graz's evident favor, Clavdra was rightly accorded a station very near that of the great lord of the place. Of course, the hyena-headed Yanogu and the scum Kosichi and certain other demons as well took precedence over her. The matter would be set right in the fullness of time, that she knew. As champion of Graz in the contest for possession of the final key, she would certainly prevail. Then would Graz bestow even greater favor upon her. The Clavdra would be a prince of demonkind, princess of demonkind, a fitting ruler, too, for all Drow to bow before. Before Eclavdra sprawled the polished, jet-pillared structure that was the grand palace of King Graz, its black marble in obsidian gleamed with mirror brightness, reflecting more darkly still the ebon foliage and the fire opalescent sky of the demon lord's realm. Soon now she would stand before the assembled court of King Graz and receive his charge. The prospect was exciting, and she relished the opportunity. Was she not named as his handmaiden after all? Now, only further honors and greater power could come to her. Eclavdra of the clan of Ilserv, soon to be known as the greatest ever of that house. All right, so breaking right here, we see that a little description of Graz's palace. It's an obsidian pillared structure, and it's the Grand Palace of Gratz, made of black marble and obsidian gleaming mirror bright. The sky, the foliage around it is ebon black foliage, and a fire opalescent sky. So we've got a little bit of a description here of Gratz's home plane. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 85 in the second paragraph down from the top. The dark elf squared her perfect shoulders, shaking her head so that her shoulder-length tresses fell like a silver frame round her lovely face, each delicate feature presented to perfection. Eclavdra's violet-hued eyes looked out from beneath long curling lashes of bright silvery color, and her sensuous mouth looked ripe and inviting as she chose, or hard and unyielding if need be. All drow females had near-perfect skin of shining black, but none among the dark elves could boast of a complexion such as she had, and well she knew this. Shoulders back, perfect breasts pointing the way beneath her filmy gown of violet to match her eyes, a single large amethyst at her throat, Eclavdra entered the palace and strode toward the great valves that gave on to the Demon King's throne room. Eclavdra, high priestess of King Gratz, a huge pair of Nabasu boomed in unison to announce her arrival. Eclavdra noticed the leers on both of those demons' hideous visages as she passed under the tall archway. They would need correction when she returned. In triumph, she thought, as she strutted past them without apparent notice of their disrespectful behavior. She made her way down the center aisle between two large groups of onlookers, approached the throne at the rear of the chamber, dropped to her knees, and bent forward at the waist in a gesture of supplication. "Arise, High Priestess," Gratz said. Eclavdra drew herself erect before the demon lord's opaline throne. Gratz had had it carved out of a single great stone, and was proud of the fact that it complemented his own coloration perfectly. Gratz's hair was blue-black, but the Demon King's complexion was the same color as Eclavdra's, and the drow agreed very much with his choice of thrones. Perhaps one day she would have a similar one, slightly smaller, for that would suit her physical stature, and of even more perfectly polished black opal than that of Gratz's throne. Being careful to display her body to best advantage as she stood, Eclavdra bowed her beautiful head and replied, "Thank you, King of Demons, Lord of the Abyss. I, Eclavdra, am before you as commanded. I have summoned you here before me, High Priestess, so that my peers and vassals may see you and hear your oath." "Yes, mighty Gratzit." "Speak then, Eclavdra." "My life and obedience are in your hands, Sovereign Lord. I humbly accept your charge and will serve as your champion in the coming contest. I have only one desire, to succeed and please my king in doing so. My lord, my life is nothing without your favor, and before accepting failure, I will die." "So be it," Gratz said with no expression. "You said well, High Priestess," he added. Then, turning to look at the crowd of demons present, the Demon King boomed, "We are now done with this audience. You are dismissed, all save our steward Vuron and Eclavdra herself. We have small matters to discuss." The demon princes and lords departed readily, followed by those greater demons, high enough in Grad's favor to be numbered as special vassals. Eclavdra's high hopes had sunk a bit at the mention of Vuron. The lord steward was an androgynous albino, as white as Grast was black. Of all the demons who associated or allied with the six-fingered demon lord, Guron was possibly the most evil and intelligent. Surprisingly, the dark elf had found him, it, unswervingly loyal and devoted to Grast. This made her both uneasy and very suspicious of the competition. Clavdra had aspired to a private conference with her master. Veron's participation was a cold and unwelcome douche to her anticipated opportunity. After taking his guest to a secluded chamber that was magically proof against all forms of spying, Brad sprawled on a divan. He motioned to Clavdra and Veron to similar furniture. Veron spoke first. "You know, I like not this proposed contest, my king. Why do you call me in, why do you call me to counsel you on it?" "Because you advocate against it, Lord Veron." This took the white-skinned demon aback. "If you plan to go ahead with Yggdrasil's scheme, of what use is my opposition?" Clavdra couldn't believe her ears. Veron had just put himself in an exposed position, and she would certainly take the opportunity to see that he regretted his foolishness. After all, was she not far better qualified to be Grat's chief advisor? Of course, just as the Dark Elven High Priestess marshaled her thoughts and readied her comment, however, the Demon King spoke. "He who trusts the devil must have a dozen lawyers to advise him on the terms that will surely be written by those of the hells. He who trusts the demon must be so powerful that no treachery can affect him. He who trusts the witch Yggdrasil is no more than a sorry fool. My lord, Huron, you are my right hand in such matters as this, but you are the least like a demon of any of the abyss that I have ever known." And it's worth noting, I mean, I like what they're talking about here with Clavdra. And in a sense, she is such an important NPC that what Gygax is saying in story is actually very revealing in lore, so that we get to see how she is, how she acts, how she thinks. And then Veron and Gratz, too, are also in creatures of lore. Veron is my favorite of these characters in the stories. And like Grast is saying here, he is unlike any other demon in the story. He doesn't really act out of evilness, but he has no real morals. So Veron acts out of expediency. I don't think he takes any delight in or any feeling for needless cruelty. He doesn't object to it. He doesn't feel like any need for it. Like, you know, like a man may have no feeling for liquor, or it's just Veron. Veron is Veron, and he stands very distinct from all the other evil characters that pop up in the story. So, yes, there's a couple mentions here. This part of the book made me wonder if Gratz had, in fact, more on the ball than some of our other demon lords. Yes, and there's definitely that. It's very interesting with Gratz. Does he really appreciate Veron's honesty? And I think Gratz is extraordinarily powerful for a demon. He really is. You know, we have these various. He talks about Demogorgon, who is Mandrilligon in this, and he has demon lord. And I think what it is Grast smart and powerful. Veron is even smarter, but I don't know if he's quite as, you know, physically or ability-wise as powerful as Grant's. But, you know, Vuron is really, you know, like the dagger in the back rather than the... He's going to do what's most expedient, what looks like the best option to win. I think that Gratzt is much stronger listening to Vuron, you know, much more powerful, because Vuron is offering him very good advice all the time, and he knows how to offer it without turning Gratzt away. It's also that Vuron really extends... I don't think Vuron has ambition, and that's because I think Vuron would much rather be the demon behind the throne rather than the one stuck trying to, you know, like Vuron isn't going to face all these attacks and things that, of course, Grast is going to. So I think it's he has the power for what he wants. And he also isn't the main target, and he need not, you know, like, I think he appreciates the position of power as Grat's right-hand demon more than he would appreciate being in the role himself. And if Grast fell, I think Vuron would look for another demon to stand behind, but maybe very difficult in finding one, because obviously Gratzt is like a cut above Yanogo or Katsuchi or any of the other demons that we've had, you know, appear in this story. Yes, and it is that Vuron is very odd, and... he is not going to, you know, that's the thing. He is not going to appeal to the dumber demons. I think Gratzt has enough intelligence to recognize the good qualities that Vuron, and I think he knows that Vuron is how good to have an advisor who is not himself going to be able to. Is unlikely to ascend to the throne, so he's very unlikely to betray you. Vuron, I think, has reached the point that he wants to achieve, and he'd like to see Gratzt get stronger, but I don't think he has the direct ambition to be... Yes, well, I think, you know, it's mentioned about the androgynous, and that the thing that does is it removes any kind of, you know, regular, you know, like the demons and such are like right from the front, where those two Nabasu are eyeing up Clavdra because of her sensuousness. There's obviously a big, you know, with these demons, there is a sexual part, which Vuron is not bothered by. So, you know, like Clavdra is not going to be, you know, distracted. Clavdra is not going to be able to entice or distract Vuron because she's, you know, a fantastically beautiful drow woman. Vuron is just not interested, and he has, you know, goals that are, you know, they're different from goals and desires, completely different from not only humans, but all, it seems, the other demons as well. All right. Where was I here? I'm going to restart. It's page 87. And it is... paragraph 1, 2, 5 from the bottom. Vuron, you are my right hand in such matters as this, for you are the least like a demon of any of the abyss that I have ever known. Vuron bowed, replying with great sincerity, "Up for yourself, great king." "Ah, I have the same weakness as the rest of our kind, my lord steward. If I exhibit any other behavior, it's because I learned the trait from you. My lord, liege, is most wise in his choice of servants, Clavdra managed to insert ingratiatingly. Your honor, you honor me too much, Veron said with humility that seemed actual. A unique thing among demons. How may I serve you, lord? I have said all I can on this matter. Perhaps, but I think not. Attend me now, both of you, and I will give you my rede. Gratz told them, there is no question that all concerned desire the continued separation of the three keys, or at least two from the remaining one. Zuckmoy certainly plots to gain two, just as Yggdrasil and that whelp Uz likewise must even now scheme to hold a pair of the Theoparts. I would have two myself. Treacherous dealings on all fronts are no surprise under such circumstances. Clavdra spoke as soon as the Demon King paused and glanced at her. As your champion, King Grast, I will not fail in securing the final key for you alone. With its power, you will surely be able to wrest the others you desire from either Uz or the Scarlet Ones. Do not seek to gain two of the keys, my liege, Yoren said as forcefully as he dared. There is a deep foreboding within me which demands I give you such warning. I believe that to hold two will surely attract the third. All know what disaster that would yield. To counsel weakness, the beautiful drow shot at Vuron. If Zuckmoy should gain even a single one, what would be my lord king's fate then? If that mushroom lover possessed two keys, all would be lost. Yggdrasil is as bad, if not worse. Clavdra continued. She would see that her associate Zuckmoy held the third, for she is surely the enemy of King Gratzt, who preached downfall to my lord king. Not so, little elf, the pale demon shot back. I urge Gratz to take the Theopart held by Uz from him, and let Yggdrasil howl and lament with her spawn. Let Zuckmoy grow wroth and full of hate. Let all of them contest with one another for the final key, for my king will have that which he needs. Best of all, he will hold it safe within the vastness of the abyss, and the whole will then never be joined. With the key, Uz and Yggdrasil are too strong for our lord to do as you suggest, for the human bitch has defiled King Gratzt, and her tricks confined him unnaturally for yet decades more. The Black Demon King raised a finger. Veron closed a mouth just open to retort, and Clavdra bowed her beautiful head in a submissive manner. My champion speaks well, Veron. Her words are true. I must have the final key, and so I must agree to the contest Yggdrasil has decided upon. I do not forgive her, nor do I forget the slightest injury. I bide my time. Opportunity will come. What you must do now, Veron, is to assist in assuring my victory in the coming struggle. Thereafter, we will consider what course to take, and then you may again counsel as you choose. Now give me your mind as I direct. All right, break. So I'm going to end there tonight. It's page 89. And so we see, you know, Euron, you know, of course, grasps the whole problem right here. Gratzt still, you know, he's got this flaw of his overweening ambition and desire for power. I forget which of the keys does what. I know one, you know, each one plays toward one of, you know, chaotic evil, lawful evil, neutral evil.
I think the Brotherhood has the lawful evil one, and I think Uz has the neutral evil one.
So yes.
So this would be the chaotic part.
And that should be for the demons, you know, because that's the one that has power over chaotic evil demons. And that would definitely be the one to grab hold of. Although, I believe Veron is arguing to get the one from Uz, neutral evil one. So I'm not quite sure, what's going on. But I was pretty sure that none of the chaotic evil had the chaotic evil, Theopart.
Right. I think that's the one that's still up for grabs.
Yeah. All right, 7 o'clock. I'm afraid I got to close out for tonight. And I had a great time. I hope I'm a little tired tonight. So I hope everybody had a great time.
I did. Good night.
All right. Good night. Night, guys.
Still there, Chris?
Yeah.
That's a great chapter. I love that chapter.
Yeah, it was good.
I recall reading when I was reading it the first time that I wondered how gratzed he's got. I was wondering if he was in fact being the James Bond supervillain, where I was his like the small town pimp from Queens or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that way.
But it's, of course, the interest comes from Veron himself. For this proposition to write some stuff for the postcard, as I was trying to say yesterday, don't want to make it complicated, but I'm really happy to try to chip in. I don't know if you've talked with Jason at all about
no, but he posted some stuff from the index, I think.
Okay, I hadn't had a chance to. I've had infrequent contact with the internet, so I'm not too sure what might have been posted. But anyway, I guess as a start, I can try to. I've read through some stuff from the Ashes and Greyhawk Wars, and trying to see what might be mentioned. Anyway,
I think happy to. Sizz wanted to. Is that how I say that? Sizz or size?
You there? Sure. You there, Sizz?
I think he wanted to be.
Yeah.
He wanted to participate too. Sizz, thanks.
Open up your mic if you want. No pressure. I guess maybe between us, we ought to settle on a kind of a outline of what it might say. I should go look at a couple of other postcards again to see what it actually gets written down.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do. Work it up, and then we can share it amongst ourselves, I guess, and edit it. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't take too long.
Here, I'm going to write down my email address here. Whoops, that's supposed to be an at. I have to make an. I've got a sticky key on my keyboard.
Yeah, me too.
There you go. Okay, note that, and you can start passing stuff around each other. It shouldn't be very hard to write, eh? It's not get exaggerated. No, I'm going to be able to write 20 pages of stuff.
Right. That's the problem. There's so much, it's just whittling it down to the key points.
It seemed to me, and I was reading a bit, that there's not a lot of for the County of Ernst that's on the plot line of the published stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's from the Ashes note that it's sort of like a breadbasket kind of place. It's got to be densely settled. It's got to be important and influential. I guess the point is, if it doesn't have a lot of tombs and stuff like that in it, the kind of gaming potentials that are offered, I guess, are sort of political in the
how peaceful it is. I thought there'd be a lot of political intrigue.
Yeah, and you've got the Pale and the goddamn Fulticians on one side, and You've got the Reni, and you've got Ayuz, and I guess, you know, we can think about a couple of other angles of trouble, and that might be about enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can mention the Nirdiv and the alliance with the Rene, the Atloy. I like that festival. I'd like to put that in if I could.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it. That's your baby.
Yeah, it's from the books. So, I mean, it documents like some of what we've learned here. So that's kind of cool.
Okay, it's Burning Man.
Yeah, it's about the size of it.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to get going and put supper on the table.
Yeah, me too. I'll type something up and send it over to you.
Yeah, okay.
All right, good night.
Take care, good night.
Bye-bye.
Night says.
Night.
Nope, he's there. He's gone already.
to a stream that was called the Lort Bum, actually, was the way it was spelled in the first source. I think this is possibly a typo, or at least a corruption of burn as in stream. And although possibly Bum isn't so out of context here, because Lort is actually an Old Norse term meaning some filth or excrement or something like that. So essentially it's like an open sewer of a stream running through the centre of Newcastle. You might be interested to know that Dean Street today is called Dean Street because it was in a dean, that is a narrow-sided stream valley,